Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
A lot to get to this hour after what has been a really busy day in Washington. Lots of movement on President Biden's cabinet nominees today, on the COVID relief effort. Just one of those days when it just seems like you're trying to watch a dozen different storylines at once. But the main event of the day at the U.S. Capitol, which is still under lockdown, surrounded by thousands of National Guard troops in the wake of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, was that today was the first investigation. Today was the first congressional hearing into what happened that day, what went wrong at the Capitol on January 6th that allowed the pro-Trump violent mob to storm the Capitol building, interrupt the certification of the presidential election, and come within just steps of the lawmakers who were in the building that day, whose blood the mob was crowing for. Today, two Senate committees took testimony from the officials who were in charge of the Capitol security that day. I should tell you, we're going to speak to the chairs of both of those committees this hour. The witnesses at today's hearing were the acting chief of the D.C. Metropolitan Police, who took over that job just 4 days before the January 6th attack, as well as three officials who resigned in the immediate aftermath of the attack: the former head of the Capitol Police, the former Senate Sergeant at Arms, the former House Sergeant at Arms. But it was interesting, and it was a sort of a surprise today the way this unfolded. Before senators started questioning those announced witnesses, the chair of the Rules Committee, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, is going to join us in just a moment. She announced what was, in effect, a surprise guest. Senator Klobuchar said that the committees felt it was important to hear from someone who was on the front lines, on the violent front lines defending the Capitol on January 6th. She introduced Captain Carnisha Mendoza, a member of the U.S. Capitol Police for 19 years. Prior to that, she was an active duty soldier in the U.S. Army. And Captain Mendoza just gave a riveting and terrifying account of her day at work on January 6th.
It was approximately 1:30 in the afternoon. I was home eating with my 10-year-old, spending time with him before what I knew would be a long day, when a fellow captain contacted me and told me things were bad and that I needed to respond in. I literally dropped everything to respond to work that day early. I arrived within 15 minutes and I contacted dispatch to ask her what active scenes we had. I was advised things were pretty bad. I asked where assistance was needed and was advised of 6 active scenes. There was an explosive device at the Democratic National Committee building, a second explosive device at the Republican National Committee building, and large hostile groups at different locations outside the Capitol building. I made my way through the crowd by yelling and pushing people out of my way until I saw Capitol Police civil disturbance units in riot gear in the hallway. They were holding the hallway to keep rioters from penetrating deeper into the building. I immediately jumped in line with them to assist with holding the crowd of rioters. At some point, my right arm got wedged between rioters and the railing along the wall. A CDU sergeant pulled my right arm free, and had he not, I'm certain it would have been broken. Shortly after that, an officer was pushed and fell to the floor. I assisted the officer to a safer location and got back in line. At some point, the crowd breached the line officers worked so hard to maintain. Civil disturbance units began to redeploy to keep rioters from accessing other areas of the building. I proceeded to the rotunda where I noticed a heavy smoke-like residue and smelled what I believed to be military-grade CS gas, a familiar smell. It was mixed with fire extinguisher spray deployed by rioters. The rioters continued to deploy CS into the rotunda. Officers received a lot of gas exposure, which is worse inside the building than outside, because there's nowhere for it to go. I received chemical burns to my face that still have not healed to this day. I witnessed officers being knocked to the ground and hit with various objects that were thrown by rioters. I was unable to determine exactly what those objects were. I immediately assumed command in the rotunda and called for additional assets. Officers began to push the crowd out the door. After a couple hours, officers cleared the rotunda, but had to physically hold the door closed because it had been broken by the rioters. Officers begged me for relief as they were unsure how long they could physically hold the door closed, with the crowd continually banging on the outside of the door, attempting to gain reentry. Eventually, officers were able to secure the door with furniture and other objects. The night of January 7th into the very early morning hours of my birthday, January 8th, I spent at the hospital comforting the family of our fallen officer and met with the medical examiner's office prior to working with fellow officers to facilitate a motorcade to transport Officer Sicknick from the hospital. Of the multitude of events I've worked in my nearly 19-year career in the department, this was by far the worst of the worst.
This was by far the worst of the worst. U.S. Capitol Police Captain. Speaking today, again, as I mentioned, this was an unannounced guest, a surprise witness at today's hearing, Captain Carnisha Mendoza. As she said, they're a 19-year veteran of the U.S. Capitol Police. But that is how today's hearing kicked off. Searing testimony from that senior Capitol Police officer on the scene on January 6th, talking about spending time with the family of an officer killed in the attack, talking about her officers coming to her as a commander on the scene, seeking relief as they physically tried to hold broken doors shut to keep the crowd at bay. That testimony formed the set, the backdrop for today's hearing. Remember how bad this thing was, worst of the worst. And then, with that understanding fresh in our minds, let us try to get to the bottom of how it happened. Well, here's one theory of what happened that day. You might think the attack on the Capitol was carried out by its supporters of former President Trump. You might think that because they carried giant flags that said Trump and because they chanted things like fight for Trump as they stormed the Capitol after a rally in which they were incited to do so by President Trump. You may think that white supremacists and other extremist groups were responsible for some of the violence that day because members of those groups have been arrested and charged in the ensuing weeks since the attack. And also because all of the witnesses at today's hearing, one after another, all uniformly confirmed that white supremacists and other extremist groups were among those who attacked the Capitol. But Republican Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin had a wildly different take today. Senator Johnson used his few minutes of question time today to muse aloud and read a right-wing blog post into the Senate record about how the whole Capitol attack on January 6th was actually carried out by anti-Trump protesters. You see, all the people who committed all the violence that day, they were faking being Trump supporters when they really weren't. It was secretly anti-Trump people who dressed up as pro-Trump people. It was like an elaborate holiday pageant. Yes, everything was all very festive, as Senator Johnson described it, until these anti-Trump provocateurs in costume started a riot. This was not like a guy heckling the hearing today. Ron Johnson was actually the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee when Republicans ran the Senate. They made him chairman of Homeland Security. Well, gee, gosh, I don't know. Have you considered that maybe this whole thing was a clever costumed stunt by President Trump's opponents? Have you considered that? I read a blog about it once on the Twitter. The Democrats now run the Senate. Amy Klobuchar runs the Rules Committee. She was one of the committee chairs running today's hearing. She said this later on today after the close of the hearing, pointedly. She said, quote, as our hearing concludes, I want to make one thing clear. Provocateurs did not storm the Capitol. They were not fake Trump protesters. The mood on January 6th was not festive. That is disinformation. Disinformation that was spread by Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin at this hearing. And while Senator Johnson used his time to spread that disinformation, his successor, his Democratic successor, who's the new chair of Homeland Security, Michigan Senator Gary Peters, who will also join us tonight, he spent his day today trying to run, you know, an actual hearing with questions and useful information that advances our understanding of what happened on the 6th.
What did you see that leads you to believe that this was a coordinated attack?
One, these people came specifically with equipment. You're bringing climbing gear to a demonstration. You're bringing explosives. You're bringing chemical spray, such as what Captain Mendoza had talked about. You're coming prepared. The fact that the group that attacked our West Front 20 minutes, approximately 20 minutes before the event over at the Ellipse ended, which means they were planning on our agency not being at what they call full strength, watching the other event, saying, hey, that event's ending. Okay, everybody get on post. They're going to be marching our way, knowing that we may not be at full strength at that time. And then also the fact that we were dealing with two pipe bombs that were specifically, set right off the edge of our perimeter to, what I suspect, draw resources away. I think there was a significant coordination with this attack.
Clearly, here we got a coordinated attack. All of you saw this immediately the way they were doing. I can imagine the conversations with the National Guard. And Chief, you were stunned by the tepid response. Could you clarify that and tell us exactly how those conversations went?
There was a phone call that was convened between several officials. Chief Sun was on the call, literally pleading there were several Army officials that were on the call. I don't know all by name who were on the call. Several officials from district government that were on the scene. Chief Sun was pleading for the deployment of the National Guard. And in response to that, there was not an immediate yes. The National Guard is responding. Yes, the National Guard is on the way. Yes, the National Guard are being restaged from traffic posts to respond. The response was more asking about the plan. What was the plan for the National Guard? The response was more focused on, in addition to the plan, the optics, how this looks with boots on the ground on the Capitol. And in my response to that was simply, I was just stunned that, I have officers that were out there literally fighting for their lives. And, we're kind of going through, what seemed like an exercise to really check the boxes. And it was not an immediate response.
One of the things that is still unclear all these weeks after the Capitol attack is why there was this apparent lack of urgency at the Pentagon that day, why the Pentagon seemed to not get what they were being asked to do and why. Why didn't they immediately respond when they got these urgent calls about the need for the National Guard to come supplant the defense of the Capitol while the attack was underway, while the violence was, in fact, heading toward its apex? I mean, this is a call that's taking place in the 2 o'clock hour as the Capitol is being overrun. They're being begged to send in the National Guard. And the response, as the chief just said there, was not an immediate yes, the National Guard is responding. Yes, the National Guard is on the way. I mean, one thing that did not come up in today's hearing, but that has still not been explained about that desperate phone call that the D.C. police chief described, is that the Pentagon initially lied about one of the military officers who was on that call. Washington Post reporting last month that after Trump's disgraced national security advisor Mike Flynn told President Trump that he should use military force and martial law to seize power despite the election results, Mike Flynn's brother was at the Pentagon and on that call, the call where the Pentagon allegedly slow walked approving deploying the National Guard. Mike Flynn's brother, Lieutenant General Charles Flynn, has denied that his relationship with his brother was any sort of factor in the response to the Capitol attack. But the Army has not explained why they repeatedly lied when they insisted multiple times that General Flynn's brother had nothing to do with that decision. He wasn't in on those meetings, wasn't in on that call, when in fact he was. And so to have one of the central figures in the president's election conspiracy and the QAnon conspiracy, one of the central figures promoting the disaster that was January 6th, to have his brother involved in the inexplicable Pentagon decision on January 6th to not send the National Guard to help the overrun Capitol Police. That seems like something we should learn more about. We need to learn a lot more about the Pentagon's lack of a response when they were being begged to respond in real time. At the end of today's hearing, Senator Klobuchar, chair of the Rules Committee, summed up a number of things that we learned from today's hearing, that there should be changes to how requests from the Capitol Police are approved when they need help or resources. There needs to be better intelligence sharing between agencies. Some security changes are needed at the Capitol building. The use of the National Guard needs to be examined, how approvals are made when more troops are requested. But then So she summed up what happened today at this hearing, which is very helpful after this dense, long hearing, especially because it's the first one that has looked at what happened on January 6th. But then as soon as the hearing was over, Senator Klobuchar announced that there is going to be another hearing next week, a second one. And that one is going to include Pentagon officials to get to the bottom of, among other things, what happened when the call came in for the National Guard. And the answer was basically no. It was de facto no for hours. So today's hearing was finally something, and it was something. It was also just the beginning. Joining us now is Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is the chair of the Rules Committee in the United States Senate, one of the two committees that oversaw today's hearing. Senator Klobuchar, I know it's been a really long day. Thanks for being here tonight.
Great, Joe. Thanks for focusing on this, and thanks for including Captain Mendoza's testimony at the beginning. That was so important.
I can't hear her.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Oh, now I'm lost in space and nobody can hear me at all. All right. This is one of those moments when I'm going to call an audible. We are going to ask Senator Klobuchar to stand by. These are our technical difficulties, I believe, not hers. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Senator Amy Klobuchar, also Senator Peters, the two senators who chaired this committee to this hearing today on the attack on January 6th. We'll be right back.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
I believe that we have tracked down, tackled, and tickled to death our technical gremlins. And that will mean that I'm able to hear Senator Amy Klobuchar, the chair of the Senate Rules Committee, when we bring her on now. If we're not, I'm out of here. Forget it. Senator Klobuchar, thank you so much for your patience. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Very good. I was just saying earlier, I was so glad you left with Captain Mendoza's testimony, which was so important to the story, all the frontline officers. But, you know, your point is what I really wanted to stress was that we need solutions here. You know, you can just throw popcorn at the screen all you want at these hearings, but if we don't get solutions out of it, we really haven't accomplished anything. And despite Ron Johnson's craziness, and despite his literally refusal to believe what everyone knows, that there was an armed insurrection at the Capitol, most of the senators treated the witnesses with respect. They asked their questions. And Gary Peters, who I know you're going to hear from today, and I both decided we want this to be a bipartisan, constructive hearing, and it was.
Senator, one of the things that I found not baffling, but I think sort of increasingly frustrating, was the ongoing discussions and in some cases contentious discussions about who had what intelligence in advance of January 6th and to what degree there were specific warnings that this could potentially be a violent event. I know that there's a lot to sort out there, but I thought you bottom lined it very well by saying, listen, this whatever exactly happened here between different agencies and between different intelligence silos here and things falling in between groups and people not finding out what they're supposed to find out, the bottom line here is that this is not a system that is set up to anticipate and handle a crisis. And I do feel like we're sort of splitting hairs here in terms of how violent everybody knew things were going to be. Looking at public source intelligence, I think a lot of people paying any amount of attention thought there was a good chance for violence. Are we getting too bogged down into who got what report when?
Questions from senators. And I think we want to get the facts so we can improve that process. And the two main things were January 3rd, they had an internal a report with the Capitol Police that they should have listened to, that reported that thousands of people were descending on Washington. And then the big one was January 5th, the night before, FBI emails from their Norfolk office. They email a report about that there is evidence that there are people showing up who want to go to war, who want to invade the Capitol. And we just find out today that the chief only found out about it in the last few days, that the sergeant at arms hadn't seen it. You can't just press send at night, but they also on their end had to have a way to see these reports. So that's concerning. But here's the things we talked about. One, better process on the intelligence, obviously. Two, as you point out, why did the National Guard take so long will be our number one question of the Department of Defense at our hearing next week. And the third thing is that this police chief reports to what is called a Capitol Police Board, which is three people, two of whom are the sergeant of arms. So I want you to picture they're guarding their members, trying to get them to secure locations. The police chief calls them because of this process that's in place to see if he can call in the National Guard. I think anyone that heard that, Republican, Democrat, anyone watching knows that we have to change that process. So there are some concrete things we can do in addition to figuring out how we use the National Guard going forward. They were at the Capitol for years after 9/11 in a smart way, how we change the security while still preserving the public nature of the Capitol. When we are through this pandemic, Rachel, we want student groups to come and we want veterans groups and people to visit the Capitol. So we cannot lose the public nature of the Capitol, but it's not going to be business as usual when it comes to the security.
I know that that decision-making process at the Pentagon, that call with request for help from the National Guard and the muddled and slow response to that, as you mentioned, is going to be the subject of the next hearing that you are going to convene on this right away next week. And I'm really glad to hear that. I have to ask, in terms of the investigation that you all have done thus far and what you've learned, including at today's hearing, is there any indication, is there any reason to worry that there may have been essentially influence on the Pentagon side in terms of slowing down the response, in terms of not allowing National Guard troops to come in and backstop the police who were getting so overrun? Was there any effort to try to let this riot run its course in a way that that is going to be not just a tragedy, but a scandal?
I don't know the answer to that question. I hope that that would not be true. What we do know, and I think it was Mitch McConnell that called President Trump's actions that day disgraceful and a dereliction of duty. We know that he wasn't making those calls to bring the National Guard in, that it was Vice President Pence, that it was the leaders of Congress on both sides of the aisle. And so we have no idea what actually went into that delay. One thing I would add is, if you want to get the National Guard deployed, some of this should have also occurred the night before, the day before that. And that also was messed up on many sides. So there are so many things that we can do. And we all saw the horror, as pointed out by Jamie Raskin and the House managers. That was a big part of the historical record, that impeachment hearing. But now it's on us to improve the security at the Capitol and to figure out exactly what went wrong. And I was actually pleased that we got these witnesses, three of whom, as you pointed out, Rachel, have resigned from their positions in the wake of what happened, to come voluntarily and answer questions in a respectful manner. I don't think anyone thought we were going to pull it off, but we believe that the public needed to know what happened. And the only way this is helpful for people is if we go forward with solutions, and that's the next step.
On that chain of command question and the decision-making question there, do you anticipate that you'll ask Vice President Pence or his staff to come in and testify about their role at any point?
Right now, we're focused on the FBI, Homeland Security, and the Defense Department because they have not come in and testified about this yet. This was the first hearing in the Senate after the impeachment trial. So that's what we're focused on. I think part of what, and I spent that evening with Vice President Pence because, as Senator Blunt pointed out at the hearing today, at 4 a.m, it was just Vice President Pence and Senator Blunt and myself walking with those two young women with the mahogany box with the ballots over to the house where Speaker Pelosi was waiting so we could finish our jobs. And I've talked to him about this directly, but haven't asked him that. I think we have to look at these in a lot of different tracks. Our job right now is to look at the domestic terrorism and figure out the solutions. Judiciary Committee will be going in that in a big way, and Christopher Wray will be testifying next week before the Judiciary Committee. And then finally, major investigations going on in the Justice Department, already people charged. And I think you heard Merrick Garland speak heartfully about how important this is to him. And all of this, by the way, is going on while we must do our other work. Get the people confirmed, and also for Joe Biden's cabinet, and also see that light at the end of the tunnel getting through this pandemic. And we had a very solemn ceremony today for the 500,000 Americans that have lost their lives. And I'm so proud that this new administration, it was just announced, up 70% from when Joe Biden came in with the number of the vaccines that they've sent out to the states. There's a lot going on here, as you point out every night. But we still have to make sure that this temple of democracy is safe.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, the chair of the Rules Committee in the Senate that convened this first hearing today on the events of 1-6 at the Capitol. Senator, thank you for your time tonight. Thanks again for your forbearance with our little with our gremlins there. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. We've got much more ahead tonight. As I mentioned, the head of this Homeland Security Committee, Gary Peters, is also going to be joining us. Lots more still to come. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Good one. The reason that Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz is opposed to President Biden's health secretary nominee, he says, is that that nominee, Javier Becerra, is not a doctor. If you're going to be health secretary, you must be a doctor, says Ted Cruz. So Senator Cruz is against Javier Becerra because Becerra is not a doctor. Nevertheless, Senator Ted Cruz voted for the last health secretary under President Trump, who was a man named Alex Azar. Senator Cruz voted for Alex Azar to be health secretary, even though you will be shocked to learn Alex Azar is also not a doctor. See, it's unacceptable to nominate a non-doctor to be health secretary unless that nominee is from a Republican president, in which case I have to go. Hola! Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina has also expressed objection to Javier Becerra being nominated as health secretary. Senator Burr's objection is that Javier Becerra served in Congress for a long time on committees that had important oversight roles on health care issues. He was involved in a lot of health care policy that way. But Senator Burr says that is not appropriate experience for somebody joining the cabinet to work on health issues. That's his stance now against Javier Becerra being health secretary. Yes, he worked on health stuff a ton in Congress, but that is not the kind of experience you need for being health secretary in the cabinet. Despite that stance now, under President Trump, Senator Richard Burr expressed great enthusiasm for a Trump cabinet nominee named Dan Coats. Dan Coats was nominated to be Director of National Intelligence. Why did Senator Burr like Dan Coats for that job so much, even though Dan Coats had never held any national security or intelligence job ever before getting that nomination?
Well, Senator Burr explained it at the time. He said Dan Coats would be an excellent choice for Director of National Intelligence. He said, quote, Dan's experience as a valued member of the Senate Intelligence Committee will help to guide him as the next Director of National Intelligence. He said, quote, I think his time on the committee has served him to understand what that role entails. So, to be clear, just serving in Congress, being on committees that work on something, that's not enough to make you qualified to serve in the cabinet on that issue. Unless you're nominated by a Republican president, and then it's okay. But if you're nominated by a Democratic president on the same basis, then you are deeply unqualified, and you must be withdrawn. President Biden's nominee for Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was approved by the Senate 92-7 today. The president's nominee for UN Ambassador, veteran diplomat Linda Thomas-Greenfield was confirmed by the Senate as well, 78-21. But Republicans are rummaging in their hats for any rabbits they can find to try to slow down or stop all the other Biden cabinet nominees that they have targeted. Javier Becerra batted down objections from Republican senators at his confirmation hearing today. Objections that Republicans are raising against him that they had no problem with at all from President Trump's nominees in similar circumstances. Today, President Biden's nominee for Interior Secretary Deb Haaland had her confirmation hearing as well. And the knock on her from Republican senators is that Deb Haaland has expressed concerns about oil and gas drilling on public lands. Well, I can see why that would be very difficult for them to swallow. You know who else has expressed concerns about oil and gas drilling on public lands? Joe Biden, who was elected president after publicly and repeatedly expressing those concerns, after making campaign promises about how he would govern as president, saying he would factor those publicly stated concerns of his into effect when he made policy as president. He was elected president saying, I'm a little worried about oil and gas drilling on public lands, and I'm going to do something about it. And so, yes, he's now chosen somebody to be Interior Secretary who agrees with him on that. It would be weird if he didn't. It would be a scandal if he didn't. He wouldn't campaign on protecting public lands from new oil and gas drilling and then put somebody in charge of that part of the government who was like, yeah, gung-ho, let's drill the bejesus out of some sacred national monuments. I can get this done. I won't tell Biden. Right? Who'd you think he was going to nominate? But these, you know, shocking revelations about Deb Haaland, that she holds the same policy positions that literally anyone nominated by President Biden to this position would hold, would have to hold in order to get the nomination. That means that Republican senators are not only going to vote no against Deb Haaland, they spent today telling her how terrible she is, and they want Biden to withdraw her nomination because it's so outrageous that she agrees with him on basic policy matters that he campaigned on. Good luck with that. Deb Haaland will be confirmed. She will be the first Native American ever confirmed to a U.S. cabinet position. And it will be celebrated by Native American communities coast to coast like nothing you have ever seen. And almost all Republicans will nevertheless have opposed her on the grounds that she, heaven forbid, agrees with the president on a major policy issue. And when almost all, if not all, Republican senators oppose her, Native communities in their states will never forget that vote, ever. Deb Haaland will be confirmed by the Senate, regardless of Republicans' bad faith objections to her nomination. And Javier Becerra will be confirmed by the Senate, again, too, regardless of Republican senators' bad faith objections to him. If you didn't care that Alex Azar wasn't a doctor, you can't complain that that's your big problem with this other guy who isn't a doctor either. That's like how you would teach a first grader about what bad faith means. Deb Haaland and Javier Becerra will be confirmed, just like Tom Vilsack and Linda Thomas-Greenfield were confirmed today, just like Merrick Garland will be confirmed as our nation's next attorney general, despite all these Republican senators now standing up and intoning solemnly about how much they're horrified by any hint of the White House trying to influence the workings of Justice Department prosecutors. You can actually read these Republican senators' lock her up tattoos through their shirt sleeves. While they are making these pious arguments as if this is something that they have strong principled feelings about, after they never once peeped about Trump and William Barr burning the Justice Department down in terms of political interference. Lock her up, lock her up.
Anyone who is arguing to you that Democrats need to skosh over to the Republican senators on confirmations, withdraw any confirmations that Republicans don't like. Anybody who's telling you that Democrats need to skosh over to the positions of Republican senators on policy and start doing things that they say they want instead of what President Biden and the Democrats campaigned on doing and what they want to do and can do, because somehow skoshing over to the Republican side will build good faith with Republicans. It'll build up goodwill. And if only the Democrats unilaterally give stuff to the Republicans that they don't need to give up, the Republicans will be so appreciative about that as a good faith sign. It'll break open a new era of substantive bipartisan cooperation. Anybody arguing that to you in this century, in 2021, is not watching what the Republicans are actually doing in the Senate or the absolutely bald bad faith with which they are behaving toward Biden nominees. But beyond Republicans trying to pull the same bad faith stuff over and over again, the other person who is playing that same bad faith game within the Democratic Party is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who is very concerned, he says, about civility, about temperament of all nominees, and he won't vote for any of them if nominees do not meet his exacting standards about civility and temperament and comportment.
Worked my tail off.
And did the word, Ralph, you used in your yearbook relate to alcohol?
I already answered the question. If you're,
did it relate to alcohol?
I like
you
beer.
Haven't answered that.
I like beer. I don't know if you do.
Okay.
You like beer, Senator, or not? What do you like to drink?
Next one is
Senator. What do you like,
Judge,
to drink?
Have you?
Joe Manchin voted for Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court. Senator Manchin voted for Trump ambassador nominee Rick Grenell, who had a rap sheet a mile long of insulting women online for their looks, women in politics. Insulting politicians' family members, ripping mostly Democrats and some people in the media, mostly women, in nasty sexist terms over and over again for years. He was like a professional Twitter troll. Joe Manchin voted to confirm Rick Grenell. Joe Manchin voted to confirm guys like that with records like that and even behavior in the witness stand like that. But he has decided this year with a president of his own party, with a Democratic president in power, that he's got a new standard now. Now he says that Biden nominee Neera Tanden, her history of having said things like, oh, calling Mitch McConnell Voldemort or calling Ted Cruz heartless, he has decided that is what violates this new line he's just drawn for civility and comportment, a line that he did not apply or even reference when considering dudes nominated by Trump over and over and over again. Right. But here, for Neera Tanden, nominated to run the Office of Management and Budget, well, this young lady better watch her mouth. New standard for her. We are watching two things in Washington right now that, where there's legitimately totally open question as to the outcome. One is actually about the minimum wage. The parliamentarian of the Senate is set to decide if the rules of the Senate are going to allow the Democrats to pass a rise in the minimum wage with just 50 votes, or will it need to be 60, in which case it won't happen because 10 Republicans won't support it. We are waiting on that legitimate open question as to what will happen there. We are also, though, waiting to see what will happen to the Neera Tanden nomination to run the Office of Management and Budget. The double standard by which she is being judged by one Democratic senator, by Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is something that so far he's mounted no defense to at all, which is getting to be astonishing given the starkness of the double standard that he is applying to her compared to the Trump nominees that he was happy to approve without any reference to all the things he's now saying are a bright line for him with this nominee. But it's interesting. In previous Democratic administrations, we might have seen them caving over issues like this. In this case, they are not. President Biden's White House is standing by Neera Tanden, not withdrawing her nomination, saying that she is their nominee and they intend to see her through. Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, also standing by her in the Senate, saying that she is the nominee and they intend to see her through. It's just Joe Manchin. It's just him. Presumably, hopefully, thinking hard about his own ethical standards. and why this particular nominee felt so over the line for him, when he's been very happy to vote for multiple Trump guys who were so far over that line, it didn't even register as a line for him at the time. I think that Senator Joe Manchin not only knows his power, but I also think that he is an introspective guy who thinks about his ethical role in the world. And I find it impossible to believe that he is not reconsidering his position on this, given the starkness of the double standard that he is applying without even any effort to defend it. The White House is not withdrawing her name, and why should they? Senator Manchin hasn't even tried to explain himself yet. I honestly don't know where this one ends, but Neera Tanden will get voted out of committee tomorrow, so the question's being called. Watch this space. One of the repeated lines today from the Senate hearing on the Capitol attack was that the deadly events of January 6th were the result of an intelligence failure. Officials testified that while they were made aware of threats of violence leading up to January 6th, they didn't expect, they weren't prepared for this level of violence. A former chief of the Capitol Police testified that based on the intelligence that they had received, his team, quote, planned for an increased level of violence and that some participants may be armed, but none of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred. Here's the thing, though. If officials were made aware of potential armed protesters, why were they not prepared for an armed insurrection? I mean, they were expecting what, like a little bit of violence, a manageable amount of armed attack on the Capitol, a containable riot? I mean, now that we're getting an investigation that we saw today with this hearing on Capitol Hill into what happened on January 6th, it still does feel like there is this elephant in the room. Honestly, there was plenty of intelligence, open source intelligence. I remember reporting on it before January 6th. Plenty of open source intelligence and available information that a mob of Trump supporters primed for and capable of violence was going to be in D.C. on January 6th during the electoral vote count. The president had called them there specifically for that date, for that reason. He had told them it was going to be wild. That was his word, wild. The underarmed, undermanned, underprepared security response to that is not because nobody knew they were coming. It is because of this still unexplained underestimation of the seriousness of the potential for violence from this kind of crowd specifically. Why is that? Joining us now is Senator Gary Peters of Michigan, chairman of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, one of the two committees that convened today's landmark hearing on the Capitol attack. Chairman Peters, thank you so much for making time tonight, Senator. I really appreciate you being here.
Great to be with you, Rachel, as always.
So one of the questions that was raised indeed on January 6th, and especially in the immediate aftermath, was the question of whether the potential for violence here was underestimated because the expected protesters were largely white and conservative were seen as allied with the Republican Party and a Republican cause. Are we any closer to discerning whether or not that perception of the crowd was key to the underestimation of their potential for violence that day?
Well, I'll tell you, Rachel, it's hard to understand how they could possibly underestimate the potential for violence with this rally. It was clear, as you mentioned, which is absolutely clear, on social media, it was all over the place. In fact, we had reports of this crowd that was going to descend on Capitol to stop the steal. And we know how the stop the steal was a code word for getting folks incredibly angry and agitated that their democracy was being taken from them. We had President Trump constantly talking about it. You mentioned his tweets calling people to come on January 6th. So it was certainly all over social media. It was pretty clear for anyone. In fact, I remember friends coming to me and saying, hey, Gary, how do you feel going to Washington? Are you concerned about what's happening? These were not intelligence experts. These were folks, men and women, friends of mine, folks on the street, it was very clear that something bad could potentially happen. But then you also had intelligence reports, as we brought up today on January 3rd, a report from Capitol Police that talked about, in fact, is what is public, is the fact that as what was going to be different from some of the activities that occurred earlier, where there was violence against groups, between groups, that this one was, the target was Congress. It was Congress itself that was going to be the target of violent activity. And if you're a member of the Capitol Police, your job is to protect Congress. And it was out there. So it is very difficult to understand why the kinds of protect or the procedures were not put in place to make sure there was adequate protection, making sure the police had riot gear to make sure that they were able to protect the Capitol close up, to make sure the National Guard was able to respond and be ready to respond at a moment's notice, which we know didn't happen.
Well, now that these hearings have started, you and Senator Klobuchar convening this hearing today, we've heard there's going to be another hearing soon with Pentagon officials. I am very interested in that question about what happened at the Pentagon when the call came in asking for the National Guard's help, and they got hemmed and hawed for hours before any National Guard troops were on the ground, backstopping those police officers who so desperately needed the help. What is your biggest remaining black box? What's the biggest open question for you that you feel needs to be answered most urgently that could potentially be answered by the kind of inquiry that you and your committee are pursuing?
Well, this next hearing is taking a broader look. Certainly what happened on January 6th and the question that we certainly need to have answered is why did it take so long for the National Guard to respond? As you recall today in the hearing, I actually asked the chief of police, the Metro D.C. police. He was on that call and he said he was shocked by the tepid, was his word, tepid response from the Department of the Army when they were calling and actually pleading for help to have the National Guard. He said the response coming back from the Army official was, well, what are your plans? What do you plan to do? When it should be, we will be there. We'll get there. Let's talk about all of that, but we're going to send folks to you right away. That didn't happen. It shocked the chief of police of the Metro D.C. police force that was the response that they were getting. We're going to ask those questions. We're going to have someone from the Department of Defense at our hearing next week. But we also need to look at the broader issue, something that I've been focused on over the last couple of years and plan to focus intently on now as the chair of the Homeland Security Committee. And that's this rise of domestic terrorism, of white supremacists, of anti-government groups. We saw it firsthand in Michigan, unfortunately, with a group that was plotting to kidnap our governor and perhaps kill her. We've seen folks descend on our capital in the state of Michigan heavily armed. This is a very concerning development. It is getting worse. We have to treat it with the seriousness that it deserves. We know that we need to get more intelligence on what these groups are up to and make sure that we disrupt any type of plots they may have to attack government buildings and officials, innocent folks, whatever it may be. We need to be better prepared to deal with domestic terrorism. And that'll be a big part of what we talk about next week. And certainly we saw evidence of that on the Capitol grounds where groups came. In fact, we heard in testimony today that there was folks that were engaged in military type operations on that ground, trying to create even more chaos and perhaps capturing members of Congress to kidnap them. This is serious business. We have to treat it seriously. It was not treated seriously by the previous administration. In fact, you could argue it was encouraged. That's got to stop. We're going to take those steps going forward.
Senator Gary Peters of Michigan, chair of the Homeland Security Committee, with a mission statement there that is, frankly, good to hear, sir. Thank you very much. Godspeed to you. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.